Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I welcome our audience here live in San Francisco and also our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce Mike Fullilove, the author of Rendezvous with Destiny, a great book about the statecraft of Roosevelt leading up to World War II. He is the executive director of the Lowy Institute in Australia, and he's also a non-resident fellow of the Brookings Institute, and he's the author of Rendezvous with Destiny. Thank you very much for coming here, Michael.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. And can I thank everybody at the Commonwealth Club, and especially George, for organising this lecture at quite late notice. I found out quite late that I was coming to San Francisco, and George was kind enough to put this on your agenda, so thank you. Can I thank you all for turning out today, those of you who are in the room. I feel that events are conspiring against my presence in San Francisco. Thank you. I arrived yesterday, and my travel agent had neglected to tell me it was Gay Pride Day, which was wonderful and wonderful for gay pride, but not so wonderful for getting from the airport to your hotel. And then today I hear there's a BART strike. So everybody is trying to stop this speech from going ahead, but good on you guys for having the courage to come out. Let me say that I haven't been to San Francisco for a number of years. It's a very charming city indeed, so I'd compliment you on it. It's a little bit like my hometown of Sydney in that it's a beautiful city. It's on the water. It has a really nice relationship with the water. It's hilly, like Sydney, whereas a lot of other Australian cities are very flat. And I spent a couple of hours walking around the city today, and I love that in Sydney, in San Francisco as well as in Sydney, you're constantly getting different views because of the topography of the city. So you'll suddenly come up, and this incredible view will emerge, and then you'll sink down into another valley, and you'll come up, and you'll see another view. Unfortunately, there were no Alfred Hitchcock films set in Sydney. That's one of the few strikes against Sydney. Whereas Vertigo, one of my favourite films, was of course filmed here, and I visited I walked past today by luck Jimmy Stewart's house in Vertigo, and I noticed that the owner has renovated it recently, so it doesn't look like that house, because I gather he was sick of people knocking on his door, which is a bit of a shame, but nevertheless. So it's wonderful to be in San Francisco. It's great to be at this famous institution, which is really important, I think, to the intellectual life of this city, as the Lowy Institute is to the intellectual life of Sydney. I've had a few questions today. I did some media on why an Australian would choose to write on a topic like this. There were three reasons, really, I wanted to write this book. The first was that I wanted to write about Franklin Roosevelt. I've long admired Roosevelt, and I believe that he's the greatest statesman of the 20th century. He saved American democracy from the Great Depression. He led the Allies to victory over the dictators. He won four consecutive presidential elections, and he did all this with a broken body at a time that was much less forgiving of those sorts of frailties than now. And he was also a seductive and effervescent figure. And that matters a lot when you are writing a book over a number of years about somebody, because you basically have breakfast, lunch and dinner with these people when you write about them. And Roosevelt is a pleasure to write about. Winston Churchill said that meeting FDR for the first time was like opening your first bottle of champagne. So I've had champagne a lot in the last few years. So first of all, I wanted to write about FDR. Secondly, I wanted to write about this period because I feel that the period between the outbreak of the European War in September 1939, which is when Australians and Europeans and actually the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, not all of the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world regards the Second World War as beginning, and Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, which is when America entered the war. It seemed to me that this was the turning point of the 20th century. It's a big claim, but the reason I make it is that, first of all, the disposition of forces in the world changed utterly in this two-year period. At the beginning of the period, the dictators were really on the march. Of course, early on in this period, Hitler invaded the Low Countries, invaded successfully, conquered France in a matter of days and weeks, and it really looked very like democracy was in peril. By the end of the period, the dictators are facing the coalition of the British Empire, the Soviet Union, and the United States that would inevitably, in my opinion, defeat them. So the disposition of forces around the world changed. But also, this was the period in which, in my opinion, the American century started. This was the period in which America was transformed from a divided, hesitant, nervous middle power with an army, for example, that just sneaked in, just squeaked into the top 20 armies in the world, to a country that was united, that was ready for the fight, and that was a global leader. And that's how it went into the war on December the 7th, 1941, and emerged from the war, of course, as the most powerful country in the world. And we're still living in the American century. Perhaps we're living in the tail end of the American century. Maybe that's a question for the Q&A. But that was the second reason. And I might say, and I meant to say it earlier, that I'm a historian, but my day job is contemporary foreign policy, and I run an institute which looks at the world. So I'm very happy. I will focus my remarks on my book, but I'm happy in Q&A if people want to draw parallels with what's happening now or Obama's foreign policy or what have you. I'm happy to address questions then. The third reason I wanted to write this book was that I wanted to write the kind of history that I like to read, and that is not history about vast impersonal forces. It is history about individuals, great characters with Olympian strengths, with enormous weaknesses and with colour to them. And I wanted to write a book that used these five individuals to tell the story, this bigger story, of American entry into the Second World War and America's emergence into the war. And I wanted a lens to tell that story. And I settled on these five individuals and the way they interacted with the events in this two-year period. Let me tell you a little bit about the story. When war broke out in September 1939, Americans were anxious to isolate themselves from the conflict. And we know that isolationism, I mean, it's hard to comprehend this now when America is so intensely involved in the world and, in fact, is at the end of a 15-year period of very, very intense involvement in the Middle East. But at this time, isolationism was a much stronger theme in US foreign policy than intervention. And Roosevelt was anxious to help the democracies in their fight against the dictatorships, but he was hemmed in by congressional opposition and public opposition. And Roosevelt's extraordinary achievement in this two-year period was to navigate these constraints and move a divided and hesitant America toward ever greater involvement in the war. Within two short years, America had remobilized and rearmed. A torrent of lend-lease aid was flowing eastward to Churchill's Britain and Stalin's Soviet Union, and the United States was fighting an undeclared naval war against Germany in the Atlantic. By the time of Pearl Harbor, at the end of my book, America's course was set for global leadership. But the question is, how did Roosevelt pull this off? America turned in this two-year period, but how did it turn so quickly? How did Roosevelt come to have faith in the ability of the Brits and the British Empire more broadly and the Soviet Union to withstand the force of the Axis attack? How could he obtain the intelligence that he craved? How could he take the measure of Churchill and Stalin when he was trapped in a wheelchair in Washington? He distrusted the State Department. In fact, Roosevelt was said to have joked after the attack at Pearl Harbor and after America had entered the war, he was said to have joked, "My State Department is neutral in this war and I hope it remains that way." He distrusted the State Department. He distrusted diplomats. He didn't like bureaucracies. He was very fond of the personal touch in diplomacy as well as politics. He was receiving reports from Joe Kennedy and other ambassadors that he didn't trust. So instead he turned to these five associates, only one of whom had any background at all in international affairs, and he sent them on special missions to Europe. First off the mark was Sumner Wells, a chilly patrician described by Time magazine as a casting director's dream of a diplomat. But he was a complicated figure, and Wells was actually eventually railroaded out of the State Department a few years after the period in which my book ends, for making homosexual advances to African-American railroad porters on the president's train, a dicey political move probably even these days. Roosevelt sent Wells around Europe in the spring of 1940 in what's called the Phony War. That is, after the Germans had invaded Poland and Czechoslovakia, of course, but before the invasion of the Low Countries and before the invasion of France. So before any of the great powers actually came to grips with each other in Europe. It's called the Phony War because the war was going on, but there was not a lot of movement in the battlefield. And Roosevelt sent Wells on a tour around Europe where he met with Mussolini in Rome, with Hitler and his acolytes in Berlin, with the leaders of the Third Republic in Paris, and with Neville Chamberlain's government in London. At this point, Roosevelt was looking for ways to help the British and the French, but he hadn't settled on an effective policy. Then if you fast forward a couple of months, by the late summer, the world had changed utterly. What had happened in the interim was that Hitler had unleashed his blitzkrieg. France had fallen, and now really only Britain and her empire remained standing, and who knew for how long. And Roosevelt now, at this point, at this critical point, this dangerous point, sent William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, war hero, lawyer, adventurer and future spymaster who set up the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA. And he sent Wild Bill Donovan to visit a lonely United Kingdom to determine whether Britain could hold out against the Nazis. And Donovan's eyewitness report, helped convince Roosevelt that this was a country worth backing, and aid began to flow at that point. In November 1940, Roosevelt was re-elected for the third time, and his war policy toughened further. Now he threw a lifeline to Britain in the form of Lend-Lease, which, unlike the previous aid, which was sort of executive aid at Roosevelt's discretion, was a massive, unprecedentedly large, national, congressionally mandated program of aid to the opponents of force. He threw this lifeline to Britain in the form of Lend-Lease, and he dispatched three special envoys to help secure it. The first was presidential confidant Harry Hopkins, the scruffy, sickly social worker born in Sioux City, Iowa, who became the whirling dervish at the centre of the New Deal. And on the day that Hitler invaded the Low Countries, Hopkins went to have dinner with Roosevelt at the White House. And afterwards, Roosevelt invited him to stay the night. And he ended up living in the White House for the next 3.5 years, and he became the closest advisor to Roosevelt on these questions. Roosevelt sent Hopkins, first of all, in January 1941, to explain Lend-Lease to Churchill. And I want to read just a paragraph or two. Churchill, of course, realised very quickly how important Hopkins was to Britain's survival. And so he duchessed Hopkins up and down the length of the British Isles and made great efforts to impress him. But Hopkins was very taciturn, laconic character, and was careful not to get ahead of Roosevelt. And so Churchill was wondering, what is Hopkins making of what he's seeing? What is he going to report back to FDR when he goes back to Washington? And they had a private dinner for Hopkins at one point in the trip. And Churchill gave his usual kind of speech, and he asked Hopkins to say a few words. And Hopkins stood up, and he was, of course, Hopkins was a very ill man. He'd nearly died of stomach cancer a few years earlier. He was very frail throughout the period of my book. And Hopkins, his face was white and drawn. He stood up and he said, "Mr. Chairman, I'm not making speeches over here. I'm reporting what I see to Mr. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, my president, a great man, a very great man. But now that I'm here and on my feet, perhaps I might say in the language of the old book," and here he paused and looked straight down the table at Churchill, "whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God." And then he lowered his voice, and he said very quietly, "even unto the end." So you can imagine that there are things that these special envoys can do. There are ways that they can communicate. that a normal diplomat would not be able to do, because this was a very special message delivered by the president's closest friend and closest intimate directly to Churchill, and it made an enormous difference in persuading Churchill of Roosevelt's bona fides. The fourth special envoy was a gentleman who's probably the most famous of all of them, Averell Harriman. And this was Harriman's first international mission. He was an ambitious, handsome railroad heir and banker. He was trying to get into politics, but for the first two terms of Roosevelt's presidency, he'd been really on the fringes of the New Deal. But he was very close with Hopkins. And when Roosevelt came up with the idea for Lend-Lease, Hopkins said, we should send Harriman to London to be the London end of Lend-Lease. And he basically worked between the Brits, working out what the British needed and trying to persuade the American, especially the American military, which was very reluctant to send any of its arms to Britain, to send it. He found time while he was in London to romance Winston Churchill's daughter-in-law, Pamela. And, of course, some of you will know that many years later, when their respective spouses had died, Pamela married Averell and became Pamela Harriman, great socialite, doyen of the Democratic Party, mentor to Bill Clinton. And when Clinton was elected president, he appointed Pamela as ambassador to France. And Pamela died actually while swimming laps at the Ritz at a great age, which is the way I personally want to go. And the Ritz was Sumner Wells's hotel when he was in France himself. So there's some nice, there's always nice closure of circles in history. Roosevelt also put to work his rumpled, charismatic opponent in the 1940 presidential election, Wendell Willkie, the Indiana dynamo. Now, Willkie is a great forgotten figure in America. He was a broad-shouldered, broad-minded Republican. He was actually a lifetime Democrat, but he wanted to be president. He was the head of one of the great utility companies, Commonwealth and Southern. He wanted to be president. He knew Roosevelt wasn't going anywhere. So he changed his voter registration, became a Republican, and a year later, basically due to public acclaim, he was the Republican nominee. And the reason was that he was a great internationalist at a time when the GOP was heavily isolationist. And during that period of 1940, people could see that events in Europe were getting more, the circumstances were becoming more and more dire and dangerous. And Willkie was the only Republican candidate who had early on said, Hitler is an enemy of the United States and we need to do something about this. And so he was made the GOP nominee. He did very creditably against Roosevelt, but, you know, ultimately he was no Franklin Roosevelt. FDR beat him by 5 million votes, but then in a way that sort of speaks to Roosevelt's genius, then turned him around and transformed him into a presidential envoy. And by sort of sending him to London in an effort to wedge the isolationists within the Republican Party. And Roosevelt did this in a very clever way, because Willkie himself didn't want to be seen as a Rooseveltian envoy. Willkie had his own political future to think about. It would be like Obama sending Romney on an important mission, and Romney, you can imagine, would be protesting, well, I'm happy to do this, but I'm my own man. And this is exactly what Willkie was saying. He was actually quite reluctant to meet with Roosevelt before he went, because he worried that he would be seen as Roosevelt's envoy. But Roosevelt was much too clever for him. And when Willkie came to see him, which was the day before his inauguration, there's two funny little stories. The first is Roosevelt's in the cabinet room and his aides tell him that Willkie has arrived, and he goes to wheel himself back into the Oval Office and he turns around and he says, gentlemen, just get me some papers. I need some papers for when Wendell comes in. And they say, what do you need? What papers do you need, Mr. President? And he said, it doesn't matter. Just give me any papers. I just want it to look like I'm busy when Wendell comes in. And the other thing he did was, when he was talking to Willkie, and he said, you must pass my regards to Churchill. And indeed, he got a piece of White House stationery, and he wrote a letter for Churchill for delivery by Willkie. And the letter quoted the Longfellow poem, The Building of the Ship. And let me read the letter to you. It said, Dear Churchill, Wendell Willkie will give you this. He is truly helping to keep politics out over here. I think this verse applies to your people as it does to us. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O union strong and great. Humanity with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. As ever yours, Franklin D. Roosevelt. And Churchill, of course, took this wonderful letter and quoted it himself, and quoted it in speeches, and Roosevelt quoted it back to Churchill, and it became a kind of metaphor for the Anglo-American relationship, which is exactly what Roosevelt intended. And then if I can fast forward to the summer of 1941, about 4 or 5 months after this. So Roosevelt has legislated for Lend-Lease. He sent Hopkins to explain Lend-Lease to Churchill, Harriman to execute, to implement Lend-Lease, to expedite it, and Wilkie to help sell both America, the idea of bipartisan American support to the Brits to boost their morale, but also to try to indicate to the American people that that there was some bipartisan support for Roosevelt's policies. But then in summer 1941, Hitler let the dice fly and he made this great miscalculation. He ordered the invasion of Russia. And again, it was the frail Harry Hopkins who dominated proceedings. He returned to Britain to confer with Churchill, and then he made a death-defying journey to Moscow to meet with Joseph Stalin. And he was the first foreigner to meet with Stalin after Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union. And Hopkins' advice gave Roosevelt the confidence to gamble on aiding the Soviet Union against the advice of most of his counsellors. In other words, Hopkins provided a character reference for the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941, just like Wild Bill Donovan had provided a character reference for Britain 1 year earlier. In late 1941, Roosevelt and Churchill met for the first time as leaders at the Atlantic Conference, which was the extraordinary meeting at sea off the coast of Newfoundland, at which the modern Anglo-American relationship was initiated, plans for aiding the Soviet Union were decided, and the Atlantic Charter was agreed between Roosevelt and Churchill. And this represented the consummation of a long-distance relationship that had been sustained through the labours of these special envoys, three of whom, and in particular Hopkins, who were present at the climax, were present at the Atlantic Conference. Of course, America really entered the war formally after the 7th of December 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And at that point, America was finally in the war and FDR was a war president. But the argument I make in the book was that Roosevelt was deepening America's involvement in the war throughout this period. He was rearming, remobilizing. He was becoming much more and more forward-leaning in his dealings, especially with the Germans. He believed in keeping the Japanese kind of off the boil while he dialed up the heat on the war in the Atlantic, provided more and more aid to the opponents of the dictators. And this, to me, is the crucial diplomatic journey of the 20th century. Let me finish with one of my favourite anecdotes from the book, which happened in January 1942, shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt goes to Congress, gets a declaration of war against the Japanese. Hitler declares war against the United States. And Roosevelt invites Winston Churchill to Washington to confer. Now, finally, I mean, they'd met in August 1941 at the Atlantic Conference, but now they would finally meet as formal allies. And these were much less formal days. And Roosevelt invited Churchill to stay at the White House, invited Churchill and his entourage to stay at the White House. And it was pretty crowded up there because, of course, Franklin was up there, Eleanor was up there, Eleanor's lady friends were up there, several of FDR's secretaries had rooms in the residence. Harry Hopkins, of course, was just down the corridor, and now Churchill and his entourage were piled into the residence as well. So it was all pretty crushed. And at one point, Roosevelt had an idea, and his idea was a name for the alliance that was fighting the dictators. And the name of the alliance that Roosevelt came up with was the United Nations. We forget now that before the United Nations was the term for the organisation, it was actually the term that the Allies used during the war for the alliance. So Roosevelt came up with this idea, we'll call it the United Nations, and he was so happy with himself he wanted to tell Churchill immediately. So he wheeled himself into Churchill's bedroom and he was horrified to find that Churchill had set up or caused to have set up in the middle of the room a bathtub, and Churchill was in the middle of a bath, and he had very unusual sort of personal habits, as some of you may know. And Roosevelt was very embarrassed in a sort of, you know, Episcopalian kind of way, and he started to wheel himself out. He said, "I'm sorry, Winston, I had no idea," and he started to wheel himself out of the bedroom. And Churchill called Roosevelt back, and Churchill stood up in the bath, naked, pink, plump, and dripping. And he declared that the Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States. So, yeah, you're right. On that visual note, I might end. I was asked to speak for half an hour, which I've done, George, and I'm very happy to take questions. Of course, on the book, of course, I'm delighted to see there's a stand of books out there for sale. Let me just get that plug in. But I'm delighted to take questions on the book or indeed on other more contemporary issues if people prefer.
Great. Now, I'd like to remind the listeners that they're listening to Michael Fulop speaking about his book, Rendezvous with Destiny, about FDR's lead up to World War II. And now it's time for questions here at the club.
Yes. I was 13 years old at the time of Pearl Harbor. I remember it pretty well. But later on, there was a feeling in some quarters that Roosevelt provoked Japan to attacking Pearl Harbor, that intelligence came through, but it never got to the White House. And the argument went on to the blame Admiral Kimmel and General Short, who were the commanders at the Hawaiian Islands at the time. So is that an apocryphal story?
Well, I think it's true that it was an intelligence screw-up, and it was a bit like 9/11 in a way, wasn't it? I mean, there were different people that had different pieces of information, and there were perhaps warnings that had got through to some people but hadn't been communicated and so on. And whichever way you look at it, it's an intelligence failure, whether it's the responsibility of those gentlemen or someone else. I don't think it's true that that Roosevelt provoked the Japanese. I think that's very hard argument to make, because actually Roosevelt was much more focused on Germany. I mean, he was a real Europeanist and an Atlanticist. And even after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, he had a Germany first policy, because he believed that the greater evil resided in Berlin rather than Tokyo. And he miscalculated how the Japanese would react to his policies, but I don't think any of us, knowing what we now know about the Nazis, could argue with Roosevelt's fundamental point, which is that was where the greatest threat to American security and indeed to the moral order really resided. I think also, you didn't mention it, but I mean it's not just that people say Roosevelt provoked them, but I mean there are conspiracy theorists who say he knew about it. And this is even more ridiculous, because no American president or leader of a democratic country would want would leave their fleet unprotected in that way. There'd be many other ways that if Roosevelt had been determined to do this, there were other ways he could do it. And Roosevelt himself was a former Assistant Secretary of the Navy and was very, very passionate about the United States Navy. I mean, he made personal interventions in terms of commands, command of different warships and so on. And he knew the Navy probably much better than any president before or since. So, in particular, the idea that Roosevelt would allow something like that to happen to the US Navy was madness. And indeed, on the day that the information came through, I mean, he was speechless and furious at the lack of preparedness in Hawaii. But I will say this. I think there was a larger sense among Roosevelt and his advisers and in his cabinet that it was a shock, it was horrible that war had come to America in the way it had come, but in a sense, it did resolve a bigger dilemma, which is that they all felt that sooner or later America would get into the war. And the one favour that the Japanese did was that they made 100% sure that the country was united behind the president. Nobody could say at that point, well, he inveigled us into this war, because America had been the victim of a sneak attack. So I think in that sense there might have been some relief, but it was certainly not intentional, and you can certainly tell anyone who reports to you that conspiracy theory that that is definitely untrue.
Thank you for your fascinating talk, and can understand every word you're saying, which is nice. A few points. I don't know what a land lease is, and what does OSS stand for? And then what do you think of all our interventions and wars? Do you think it's better to be at least a little more of an isolationist? And also, did many Australians fight in World War II? He might not
remember. No, thank you. Those are all good questions. Lend-Lease was basically Roosevelt's way of... It was Lend-Lease, OSS, is a bit of isolationism good, and the last one was Australians. A lot of Australians fought in the Second World War, mainly in the Pacific Theatre, of course, mainly against the Japanese. Although in the First World War, they fought mainly... Obviously, they fought mainly in Europe. But, yeah, many Australians fought alongside Americans in many campaigns in the Pacific. Lend-Lease was Roosevelt's brilliant way of selling to the American people the idea of giving billions and billions of dollars in an unprecedented transfer of arms between two countries. Because essentially he was concerned and believed probably correctly that the Congress would not allow him to simply write almost a blank check to initially to the French, to the British, to the Soviets. So Roosevelt came up with this idea of Lend-Lease, which was, we're not giving them these arms, we're lending them the arms. And he used the metaphor of a man whose house is on fire and who borrows a stretch of garden hose from his neighbour. He says, of course, the neighbour wouldn't ask him to buy the hose. The neighbour would just say, use the hose and return it to me in good condition when you're finished. And if you can't return in good condition, then buy me another one. And so this was Roosevelt's argument. He said, we've got to get rid of the foolish dollar sign. We've got to have this process for lending or leasing. Of course, no one wants a used shell or a used tank or a used warship or anything like that. It's like, as one Republican congressman said, it's like asking for someone to return the chewing gum that you've lent them. But this was Roosevelt's brilliance. I mean, he used the metaphor to carry it off. He used it to explain to the American people, who were pretty reluctant to do this, why it was important that they do it. The OSS was the Office of Strategic Services, and it was essentially the first US intelligence central international foreign espionage organisation. So previously, Roosevelt, there were different elements of... There were different intelligence agencies in the different military services and the State Department and so on. And Roosevelt set up the OSS as a sort of freewheeling civilian foreign intelligence organisation. And the OSS was disbanded at the end of the war by Truman, and the CIA was the successor organisation. A lot of OSS people went over to the CIA. So, in fact, if any of you are ever lucky enough to go to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, you'll find a bronze statue of Bill Donovan in the foyer, because he's regarded as the father of US intelligence. But this was, as was the case for most of these guys, this was Donovan's first step on the international stage in this sort of big international role in this book. He impressed Roosevelt so much that Roosevelt later appointed him head of the OSS. In terms of the isolationism question, of course, any country has a mix of, if you like, isolationism and interventionism, and it's about finding the right balance. I think it's impossible for a country like America, which has such global interests, to be isolationist. It would be madness, and you would forego your ability to structure things in ways that suit your national interests. I mean, America's has underwritten a lot of global security since the Second World War, but it's also shaped the world in ways that are conducive to American interests. If the world had been shaped by the Soviet Union, for example, it would be a very different world and one that's much less pleasant, really, for the United States. So I think you do need to be involved, but that doesn't mean that America has to be involved in every single conflict and every single war. And so it's a matter of finding the right balance. You know, I would argue, for example, and argued at the time, that the Iraq War was foolhardy for America in the sense that there was no obvious reason to go into the war, and of course it's turned out to be extremely expensive. 4,000 American servicemen lost their lives, cost, you know, trillions of dollars, and at an enormous an opportunity cost. Think of all the things that America could have been doing since 2003 if it had not been involved in Iraq. So I was against the Iraq War. I think that was a foolish thing to do. But that doesn't mean I'm against American participation in every war. It's about finding the interventions that are smart and that serve America's interests and the wider interest.
Thank you very much. I really appreciated your presentation. A long question is, what other statesmen did you consider prior to saying FDR was the greatest of the 20th century? Mm-hmm. The second question, very short one, how do you feel, what do you regard when you walk into United Nations Plaza here in San Francisco?
Help me out with that last question. I don't.
To the Opera House.
Uh-huh.
It's between the Opera House and Herbst Center.
Right. And what is it? What do they do at United Nations Plaza?
That's what it's titled. That's where was founded.
I see. What do I feel? Well, I've never walked in there. I can tell you what I feel when I walk into UN headquarters in Turtle Bay in New York. I mean, it's hard to feel sort of passionate about the United Nations because, you know, it's an odd organisation. I mean, it's made up of almost every state in the world. There are lots of good people in the UN Secretariat and lots of deadwood. And the decisions are naturally very hard fought in the Security Council because all those different countries have different interests. So I'm not a UN groupie. I'm not somebody who says the UN right or wrong, and whenever they look at global issues, they put the blame at the feet of the Americans. I'm not one that looks like that. But I would say the UN is important. The Security Council is important. Australia sits on the Security Council at the moment. And I felt that it was important for us to campaign for that seat. Because ultimately, what the Security Council decides in terms of the use of force, which is what it's mainly concerned with, has makes an enormous contribution as to whether the world perceives that use of force to be legitimate or not. So, for example, the Iraq War, famously, the Americans and their allies could not get a Security Council resolution authorising the use of force against Saddam Hussein's regime. And I think that affected the legitimacy of the war in the United States and around the world, and that's one of the reasons why there was so much anger around the world at America's decision to do it. Whereas I think if America had been armed with a resolution of the Security Council, I think that would have lowered the risks and the costs and it would have made it seem more legitimate. So to go to your question, what do I feel when I go to the place that was the founding of the place where the United Nations was founded, and apologies for not making the connection immediately, or what do I go to UN headquarters now? I feel this is an important place where international business is transacted, but it's not something. It's not a place I feel deeply emotional about. In terms of other statesmen, I mean, it depends on the criteria that you wish to apply. One could say, for example, that Nelson Mandela, who appears to be gravely ill at the moment, was the great, you know, one of the great moral figures of the 20th century, and I believe he was. And I was lucky enough to meet him on one occasion, and I can tell you that I got a buzz out of that I've never had out of meeting any other famous leader. But I guess and one could also make, I suppose, the other person that historians often posit is Winston Churchill. And it's absolutely true that Churchill had this incredible moment, which was really in the second half of 1940, when Britain stood nearly alone, and when he symbolised resistance to Hitler and the dictators. But I don't think Churchill was as important a statesman as FDR. I think we remember Churchill for that intense period of 6 months or a year. That's when he gave all the big speeches, that most of the big speeches that people think about. We forget that his career was marked by failure and mistakes before that as much as it was by success. And as the war went on, Britain actually became a less and less important player in the Allied coalition, dwarfed by the Soviet Union's effort and also by the American effort. Whereas the reason I would argue that Roosevelt was the most important statesman was that he left his mark. I mean, this guy was president for three and a bit terms. He left his mark on almost every aspect of American society, whether it's the welfare policies of the country or education policies, or importantly, the response to the Depression when he first came into office, or indeed, and most importantly, the rise of the national security complex in the United States and American entry into the war and American emergence as the global leader. I'd say the width and the breadth and the length of Roosevelt's contribution is what seals it for me. But that's not to say that I don't admire Churchill. I admire him very much, and the same goes for Mandela. But I think in terms of importance, I think Roosevelt is it.
Thank you. More current events, since you said you're willing to do that. Are you truly shocked at the level of digital surreptitious monitoring that nations have been conducting? And do you believe that there is potential for permanent damage to this United Nations, not the UN, but our allies, as the newspaper headlines imply?
Well, I'm shocked that anybody could be shocked that countries spy on each other. I mean, I separate that comment from these comments from the revelations about NSA data gathering in the United States, because that raises a separate question about, and as an American, it's not really up to me, but as Americans, it's up to you to decide what level of sort of supervision, if you like, you're prepared to accept as a trade-off for the protection that the government extends to you. I think that's a legitimate question. It's a constitutional and legal question, really. But on the issue of foreign espionage, which is what the headlines that you're referring to in today's New York Times, for example, I mean, it's just baloney. Everybody spies on everybody. Having guess what, the Americans have bugged some offices in Europe, and I'm sure the Europeans bugged the American offices, and I can tell you in Canberra, we bugged the Chinese embassy famously, and, the Chinese are... This is not classified information. Everybody knows this. The Chinese are now building a new embassy. The Chinese apparently have bugged our domestic intelligence organisation. I mean, not for nothing that people say it's the world's second oldest profession. Of course it happens. And, of course, everybody's in high dudgeon, and the Europeans will be issuing, outraged statements. Well, those people should first ask their own leaders to put their hands on their hearts and say that they don't spy on anybody else. And, of course, they do. Everybody spies on everybody.
Thank you for a great presentation. The man you described, we seem to have lost that level of statesmanship and vision in the world leaders that we have today. And they seem more like children not playing together wisely. Would you comment on that?
I think it's true that this period, I mean, cometh the moment, cometh the man, I suppose. There is something about a global conflict that conjures up the best and the worst in human character. But certainly, if you think of the figures in this book, whether it's FDR himself or Churchill or, on the other side of the ledger, Stalin and Hitler, I mean, these are titanic characters, aren't they?
That's my point.
Yeah.
What happened to that?
Well, I think the It's hard to. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I can say that. You know, it's good and bad. I mean, we don't have the Roosevelts and Churchills. We don't have the Hitlers and Stalins either. I think that there are many awful things happening in the world, but not at the state, not at the same level of bloodiness and brutality and evil that happened in the Second World War. So that's something to give thanks for. But in terms of your question on the positive elements of statesmanship, I think that in a way, it's not just that they're not even so great, it's that they're not so much fun. I mean, you know, these characters are incredible. These guys are incredible characters. I think that you could get away with things in that period. The media wasn't so forensic in the way that it examined you, and you could get away with stuff. And you could get away with doing the wrong thing as well, but you could also just get away with being a bigger character, whereas nowadays they have to be so disciplined. You know, they're so focused on fundraising and all the rest of it that it's very rare to get somebody who rises up. I'm a measured extent I'm a fan of Obama's. I think Obama has certainly run a much more prudent and intelligent foreign policy than his predecessor did. He's certainly avoided the big mistakes that George W. Bush made. I think if there's one contemporary angle that I think about that sort of comes into your question a bit, you know, one of the things that Obama has indicated he wants to do and he's tried to do is to rebalance American policy towards Asia, my part of the world. And I think that is very much overdue. I mean, if you look at where America's real opportunities and challenges in the future are going to lie, it's not really in the Middle East. It's not really even so much in Europe, although, of course, those two regions are always going to be important to America. Where is the economic growth going to come from? It's in the Pacific. Where are the challenges going to come from? In Asia. Where is, you know, China is a potential peer competitor of the United States in a way that even the Soviet Union wasn't. But here's the problem. And Obama has seen that, whereas most American politicians haven't. He's seen it. He's signaled it. And he gave a speech in Canberra, actually. I watched the speech in Parliament House in Canberra, where he signalled that. But here's the problem. This is an enormous, complex country, and it is very difficult to pivot a country as big and difficult and demanding and complicated and chaotic as the United States. And in a sense, my book is about the last great successful pivot that an American president took the country on, where Roosevelt pivoted America outwards. So it became less domestic-focused and more outward-looking, and it pivoted it in particular towards Europe. And now Obama, in a sense, is trying to pivot the country towards Asia, but it's a very hard thing to do. And whenever I see it, whenever I see Obama trying to do this and there's Kerry trying to bring peace to the Holy Land, or people are saying to America, you've got to get involved in Syria, I'm reminded of The Godfather Part 3, where Michael Corleone is finally trying to go straight. But he keeps getting, you know, caught up in the Cosa Nostra's dealings, and he says, just when I think I'm straight, they pull me back in. And I feel it's a bit like that for Obama. I mean, just when he thinks my positive foreign policy agenda will be to deepen America's involvement in Asia, something happens in the Middle East and he has to get involved, and I'm sympathetic towards him. But I think it's tough for him to pivot the country.
He's the closest, I think. To what extent is the great statesmanship an outcome of the great decisions that need to be made, and aren't those a lot clearer or easier to make, actually? Like I said, he pivoted the country, but then all of a sudden it was very clear what needed to be done. Hmm. So there was preparation and then clarity. It makes it easier to decide.
Yeah, I guess, except when you look at the debate in this period, in 1930 to 1941, 1939 to 1941, and certainly when you look throughout the 1930s, there was no clarity among Americans about what to do. I mean, there was clarity when Roosevelt helped bring them to clarity, and then when the Japanese really helped. But a lot of these decisions, in retrospect, look completely obvious, and you sort of say, oh, well, of course they would do that. But at the time, it wasn't, and Roosevelt had to make this argument that America should be more and more involved in events overseas. And he did it through a deluge of speeches, broadcasts, fireside chats, these special missions, decisions. You know, it was an incredible sustained feat of political decision-making and public diplomacy. And really, I guess that's the point I'm making here, that that's what it takes to move a country as big as America. And it's hard for a president now to get headspace or media attention in order to do that, because there are so many events that are constantly turning his or her head.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We've heard a lot about what FDR did really well, and I'd love to hear, and your research and learning about him over breakfast, lunch, and dinner, what was his biggest mistake or his greatest character flaw that you kept kind of stumbling upon and saying, why are you doing that? You should be doing, you know, you should be changing that.
Okay. You're asking me to diss Franklin Roosevelt, are you? Well, I'll tell you two. I won't say mistakes, but he made many mistakes, but I'll tell you two character flaws. One was, you know, obviously his marriage was not a success. And it's funny, you know, there are sort of two tribes of people who study Roosevelt. There are those who study Roosevelt, who are predominantly male, who study Roosevelt and the war, Roosevelt and Washington politics, court packing and things like that. And there's another tribe of people who study Eleanor mainly. And they're mainly women, not exclusively, but mainly. And I remember once sitting at a cafe table at the Roosevelt Library in upstate New York. And these people were having a real argument, what I would call a Barney, a real set to about the Roosevelt marriage. And all the women at the table, the female researchers, were saying, well, Franklin was disgraceful. He slept with... you know, he slept with this woman, and then we think he probably slept with this secretary, and it was awful. How could he do that to Eleanor? And all the men on the other side are saying, but Eleanor was never there when Franklin needed him, and why was she racing around the world when he needed companionship? Of course she did that. And I was just sitting on the side thinking, you people need your own marriage, you know. But it is true that Roosevelt strayed at least once. It's true that the marriage was really an unhappy marriage, and they didn't really, the truth is they really didn't give each other what they needed in a life partnership. And yet, in another way, it was a great success, and they kept it together, and even though they had lives that were to some extent separate, they didn't take the easy option. Well, I suppose it wouldn't have been easy in those days. It actually would have been very politically difficult. But, you know, we remember it as a great partnership, but not as a great marriage. The other character flaw I'd point you to is that Roosevelt was, he was Clintonian in the sense that he liked to tell people what they wanted to hear. He didn't like telling someone something they didn't want to hear. He could be very ruthless in cutting people off, but he didn't like telling them what they didn't want to hear. So William Bullitt is one of the characters in my book, and he hated Sumner Wells, partly because Wells had been sent on this mission, and he undermined Wells, and he ruined Wells, essentially. And Wells, you know, was forced out of the State Department and went into a life of alcoholism and loneliness and sexual wantonness, and died a really lonely individual. And Roosevelt hated Bullitt for doing this, but he didn't say it to Bullitt's face. And Bullitt came to him and said, I'm going to run for mayor of Philadelphia, Mr. President, and because he was from an old Philadelphia family. And Roosevelt said, fine, Bill, you should do that. And then he sent a message to the political bosses in Philadelphia, cut his throat. this is how Roosevelt operated. And there's a joke that people tell about Roosevelt, which is probably it's too good to be true, so it's probably apocryphal, but it contains an insight, nevertheless, about FDR. The joke goes that Harry Hopkins came back from London on one of these trips. He went in to see Roosevelt and said, Mr. President, I'm just back from London. I've seen Winston Churchill. We've got to help these people. They're fighting the good fight against the Germans. We have to do this. And FDR said, Harry, you're absolutely right. And then Harold Ickes, who was Hopkins' great rival, came in and said, Mr. President, I know that Hopkins has been in here. I know what Harry will have told you. We can't afford to do it, Mr. President. We need to extend the New Deal. We need to bring blacks and women into the New Deal. We can't afford to do it yet. And FDR said, Harold, you're absolutely right. And then Eleanor, who'd been listening in an anteroom and, of course, was very prim and sort of disapproving of this side of Franklin. So you can see which side of the FDR Eleanor thing I fall down on. But anyway, Eleanor came in. She said, Franklin, that was disgraceful. First of all, Harry Hopkins told you one thing and you said you're absolutely right. Then Harold Ickes told you the opposite thing. You told him you're absolutely right. What have you got to say for yourself? And FDR said, Eleanor, you're absolutely right.
Why did Germany declare war on the United States when Japan attacked? They already had Russia and Great Britain on their plate.
Right.
Which would have seemed to be quite a lot.
Right.
So was there some pre-existing agreement between Germany and Japan that Japan attacked that Germany would declare war?
It's a good question. We still don't know the answer to it. I mean, a lot of historians would say that Hitler's decision to declare war on the United States and his decision to declare war on Soviet Union were two of the biggest mistakes he made. But I think that, there was a clear understanding on the part of the Japanese that if they went to war with the Americans, the Germans would pile in. And, they were increasingly coordinated in their activities. And I think actually it would have been unsustainable. I mean, even if he hadn't declared war immediately, by then, don't forget, as I said, America was fighting pretty much an undeclared naval war against Germany in the Atlantic. I mean, they were sinking each other's ships in the Atlantic. So pretty soon, if he hadn't declared war then, I mean, you can't say for sure, but it would have been very difficult, I think, to keep them separate. I think those two conflicts, the Pacific War and the Atlantic War, which had been hitherto sort of separate conflicts, I think they were getting closer and closer. So he probably took the view, it's going to happen, why not do it now, and I'll be the person who does it and I'll get on the front foot.
Sydney, one of my favorite cities as well.
Thank you.
Two possible mistakes, I think they were. He did not tell Truman about the A-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Truman, his vice president, didn't know about it.
And you're talking about Franklin's mistakes, not my mistakes.
Franklin.
Yes.
Yeah, Franklin's mistake.
I was wondering
where
you're going, yeah.
And also, he probably shouldn't have been elected his fourth term. He wasn't well, form of dementia perhaps. But Churchill warned him about the growth of the Iron Curtain, the speech that Churchill made in Westminster College in Missouri, and that they told Eisenhower, stop at the Elbe and so forth, that he was very naive as to the future situation developing in Russia against the U.S., etc.
There are many mistakes. As I said, FDR was president for a long time. He made many, many mistakes.
There's time for one more question.
That was just a short answer.
We
could get into those, and there are other mistakes. Court packing is often said to be his great political mistake that ruined him. These things are all true. He made many, many mistakes, and yet I still come back to the point that nobody left their fingerprints on the 20th century in a heavier fashion than FDR.
I always like the sports analogy. The sports analogy that if you have a 400 batting average in baseball, you're still doing very well, and you're making 6/10 of the time a mistake.
I would like you to comment on your perception of current media. The seems to be the vast array of misinformation, and compare it to what perhaps existed, not the extent of what, but the intellectual basis that that people are getting now, or lack of, in educating themselves and making. You mentioned about pivoting the conversation, but the role of the media in doing that and bringing good information to.
Well, it's interesting. People always complain about the media, but looking at the media in these days, it was pretty wild, and the debate was pretty partisan and bitter. So I'm always a bit, the historian in me is always a bit sceptical of claims that things have never been as bad as they are now, because the media was vicious, the political debates in Washington over these questions were absolutely vicious. And so it comes back to leadership. It comes back to how do leaders maneuver their way through this media? How do they take account of it? How do they... Media changes. It's much quicker now, of course. So how do you adjust to that in ways that allow you to put forward your agenda? And this is Roosevelt's great achievement, that despite a lot of the media being against him, the public being very anxious about it, Congress legislating through the Neutrality Acts to fence America off from conflict, somehow he managed to get America through, and yet he also did it in a way that he took America with him. And I guess that's the final lesson I'd finish on. I mean, if you think of the way that Roosevelt took America to war, in the Second World War was sort of the opposite, actually, of the way that George W. Bush took America to the Iraq War. Bush did it quite quickly. He did it without caring too much about using the media to create a bipartisan support for the war, and he did it with very little international support. Actually, Australia was one of the very few countries that went along with it. Roosevelt did the opposite, very patiently, very carefully conjured up a bipartisan domestic consensus, did it by dramatising what was happening, bringing that back to Americans. And until the point where he did it, when it was completely legitimate, he used other countries like the British and the Soviets and the French as proxies in a way. So to answer your question, I think the media is critical, but complaining about the media is like complaining about the weather. I mean, they're there, they're going to do what they do, and so the role of politicians and statesmen and stateswomen is how do we get past the frailties of the media? How do I use the media to get my message across, and how do I prevent myself from being pushed off balance by the media in order to achieve the things that I need to achieve? And Roosevelt, that's what Roosevelt was able to do.
Michael, I think you're absolutely right about that. Well, thank you very much for another great lecture here at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
As Michael mentioned, the book is available, and he'll be signing. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.